Edward Cans is an author, naturalist, guide, and photographer from the Adirondack Mountains. He writes regular columns for Adirondack Explorer and has written for Birdwatchers Digest. And his work has also appeared in Adirondack Life, Audubon, The Conservationist, Natural History, and many other magazines. His latest project is a beautiful new book called The Nature of the Place on the Flora and Fauna of the Adirondacks. It is a love letter to his home, the Adirondack Park, where he gathers materials from his columns and elsewhere, revising them and trying to give us all a look at the flora and fauna of his home. Again, the name of the book, The Nature of the Place, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Edward Cans to the roundtable this morning. Edward, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Much appreciated.
What brought you to want to write such a book of really bringing us to this magical part of a magical place?
Well, I'm a nature nut, a nature nerd, I guess, have been since birth. My earliest glimmers of consciousness are all nature memories, pretty much. And I grew up downstate near White Plains, New York, but my mother's side of the family go back to the 1700s in the Adirondacks. I always wanted to live up here. I always wanted to be part of this place, have this place be part of my life. And my wife and I finally moved here in 1999, 26 years ago, and I don't think you could drag us out of here now. And the Adirondacks are so often celebrated for their recreational opportunities, and I really felt there was a need here for more attention to the flora and fauna, which the book is about.
When it comes to just that, the flora and fauna, talk about what parameters you set for yourself in writing the book of what you wanted to, of what the rules were, of what you wanted to write about, of what exactly you wanted to include in the volume.
Well, I'm not much of a rules guy, Joe, so, I just sort of followed my nose, I guess. The book collects pieces previously published in Adirondack Explorer, which is a regional news magazine, and they had a bird column by the time I came along, so I wasn't allowed to write about birds. So all those pieces I drew from a newspaper column that I wrote for a Connecticut-based chain for many years. And I'm somebody who's just, interested in everything. When I introduce myself to people, I sometimes say I'm a little bit of everythingologist. And so this book sort of goes in all sorts of different directions.
So the way that you, is it safe to say that you have other parts to the book, so there's chapters to the book? So how have you broken it down in that way?
Well, I tried to organize the book in a way that sort of makes sense to people, and most of us are willing, accustomed to the basic way we tend to divide up life. So the early part of the book is on mammals, and then there's a big section on birds. I'm interested in reptiles and amphibians. They were actually sort of my first love in nature. So there's a section on those with a few miscellaneous things thrown in, like earthworms and leeches and fish and freshwater sponges, which most people have never heard of. Got a section on insects, section on plants, and I even have one section on things that are hard to find a pigeonhole to stick them in.
When it comes to, like, the book starts off with not to give anything away, but the moose makes an early appearance in the book, which I think is certainly makes sense. Give us a sense of why. Let's just use this as an example, but why the moose is such a part of the Adirondacks, and when we think of the Adirondacks.
Yeah, great. Great question, Joe. Moose are a member of the deer family. They're the world's largest deer, and they're really the deer that's best adapted to living in the Adirondack Mountains. So when the American Indians were here, some still are, of course, the moose was a major player here in the ecology, and the Europeans came along. Unfortunately, in the early years of sort of European settlement and even tourism in the Adirondacks, there wasn't any much to eat here, weren't grocery stores, convenience stores, the granola bar hadn't been invented yet. So people had to shoot and kill, what they ate while they explored the Adirondacks. And the moose were killed off fairly quickly. It's pretty easy to shoot to kill a moose. They're so big, and they're actually often called in with sounds. And by 1862, the last Adirondack moose was dead. So in the 1980s, the moose decided to reintroduce itself. Genetic studies show that they came over from Vermont, and the moose has been making a slow comeback ever since. And they're a really big deal. They're one of the biggest animals in the Adirondacks. The moose and the black bear can both weigh around 800 pounds at sort of maximum size here in the east. They're big, they're beautiful, they're interesting, and everybody wants to see one, and most people haven't seen one at this point, so which was another incentive for me to write about them.
What does that say about them and about how they live that so few people, there are so many of them there and so few people see them?
Yeah, that's an interesting conundrum, and I think it has something to do with the fact that while they're very big, they do spend a fair bit of time standing in one place, sort of munching, and they're also very dark, and big, dark things are hard to spot in nature. So we have thousands of black bears in the Adirondacks, a lot more black bears probably than there are moose, but most people don't see those either because big, dark objects in the woods just tend to blend in. The Adirondack forest is sort of dark and shadowy and moody and just lovely and alluring, and it's hard to spot things that just sort of look like shadows. So moose are out there, but they amazingly, despite their big size, they're hard to see.
Are the bear that we see in the suburbs that bother our bird feeders and occasionally go after neighborhoods, are those the same bears that will find themselves in the same species, find themselves in the Adirondack Park?
Yeah. In fact, we're probably some of the source of your mischievous bears because we got a big breeding population here, and the bears are flourishing, and we're probably producing more baby bears than we have room for, so that's the way it is with wild animals. The landscape is sort of saturated with, a species like the black bear. And so the parents are having young, or the mother bears give birth, I think, every other year typically. There's not enough room for all these bears, so they move out and look for other places to go.
Yeah. And hibernation, yes?
Well, that's a good question. Some biologists would get red in the face if you suggested that black bears hibernate because they don't have a big body temperature drop when they go into their den for the wintertime, and their heart rate does not come to a near stop as the really deep hibernators like woodchucks and jumping mice do. But on the other hand, I tend to think of bears as hibernators, and I think many biologists do too. They don't go into a deep, profound hibernation. You could wake a bear up if you tried hard enough, if you could find it in its den, and biologists occasionally do that and aren't happy about it. But anyhow, they disappear for months. They snooze most of that time. They don't feed. They don't drink. So it seems pretty hibernation-like to me.
Now seems just as good a time as any to talk about the impact on climate change and how animals react to it. I mean, if so, naturally the temperature would often dictate the behavior of any animal. And I'm interested in what we're seeing in the Adirondack Park as a result of increasing temperatures.
Well, I think we're seeing bears active later in the fall, active maybe earlier in the spring. We're certainly seeing a big difference in birds here where we live in a little town called Bloomingdale, not far from Saranac Lake. We are seeing birds now from time to time that we never used to see here, things like house wrens and blue-gray gnatcatchers, towhees. There's a lot of songbirds that live sort of just south of the Adirondacks. It's been a little bit cold and snowy and maybe not the right kind of forest here for them, but with the warming climate, they're able to survive, some of them anyhow, and they're moving in. and we're seeing them and we're hearing their songs.
Edward Kanz is the author of the new book, The Nature of the Place on the Flora and Fauna of the Adirondacks. You bring this up early in the book, but I think it's a great point, and it's something I wanted to talk to you about. You talk about, you say, bobcats, Canada lynx, mountain lions. Opinion varies widely in the Adirondacks regarding the status of these big wild cats, all natives of the region. Why is it sort of an unknown as to, I guess you say in the book that you know bobcats because they turn up dead often, but as far as the other cats and just exactly what we know for sure is in the Adirondack Park?
Well, it's hard with anything to prove that something doesn't exist, so there are those who believe we have a lynx population in the Adirondacks and a mountain lion population, and I certainly can't prove them wrong, but I think the evidence is convincing to me that they're generally not here. There were lynx here historically, but the lynx is an animal that's not very subtle. Well, any of these carnivores, they carnivores like bears and lynx and mountain lions, bobcats, they have to cover a lot of ground. So while they're covering that ground, they might not get seen that often if they're secretive, but they can't move without leaving traces. So while we see bobcat tracks all over the park and all over the woods, we see them around our house, we don't see lynx tracks. So even in neighboring Vermont, lynx are sightings are generally not occurring anymore. But who knows? You know, there are lynx up in Canada. The lynx, my guess would be, will eventually reintroduce itself to these mountains. But it seems to be gone. The mountain lion is even less subtle than the lynx in terms of this is a big animal, and it kills deer. It can't eat a deer in one sitting usually, so it often takes a deer that it's eaten part of and stashes it in a fork in a tree, which is a pretty conspicuous sign of the presence of mountain lions. And out west, where there are well-known population of mountain lions, they're frequently hit and killed on highways by cars because it's easier for these predators to move along trails, along roads and things than it is to move in the dense forest. Anybody who tries to go for a bushwhacking hike in the Adirondacks learns how difficult it is to move through the forest here. So anyhow, if these animals, if the mountain lion was here, we should be having road-killed mountain lions. We should see lots of tracks. We should find the occasional deer stashed in the fork of a tree, and we're not seeing these things. At the same time, there was a mountain lion killed by a car in Connecticut some years ago, and that mountain lion, as it turns out, somebody had collected some hairs after a mountain lion sighting in the Adirondacks, and the DNA matched this cat, this wild mountain lion that was hit and killed by a car in Connecticut. So that DNA of that mountain lion showed it had come all the way from South Dakota. So while the evidence convinces me, or lack of evidence, that we don't have a mountain lion population in the Adirondacks, that doesn't mean you couldn't see one the day after tomorrow if one wanders here from some faraway place.
I recently saw a bobcat and was, I mean, I'm comparing to, let's say, you know, your average cat, but they're very large, sturdy animals, aren't they?
Yeah, the bobcat, they're not that big. They're, you know, sort of beagle-sized bobcats. But they're very powerful, and they can, a study in the Adirondacks found that they regularly prey on white-tailed deer, even adults.
And as far as in a fight between a bobcat and a deer, the deer just can run, right? Is that what their defense?
Yeah, that would be the chief defense. But deer, you know, deer can kick. I know it's said that if you see an injured deer, and you wanted to help it, you should be very, very cautious approaching it because one kick from one of those sharp hooves could disembowel a human being, which wouldn't be much fun. So anyhow, the deer is can do more than run, but certainly running is its first line of defense.
Well, not to take this in a dark place, but you hear that when vehicles strike deer and they often go into the car, and then when they try to get out, that can often cause problems because of that kicking. You have a section in here I wanted to ask you about raccoons. You say with raccoons, you either see too much of them, or when you have friends visiting from overseas and you want to show them one, there's neither hide nor hair to be found. So they're pretty good. They're pretty good of staying out of it.
Yeah. Raccoons, they're amazing. You know, they can be very secretive, like many wild animals, but they can be too conspicuous at times. Also, they're intelligent, they're inquisitive, they like to eat just about everything, sort of like us.
Yeah.
So they are a major presence. And you mentioned climate change earlier, Joe. The raccoon is maybe a good example of that. Where we live, we didn't have raccoons, really. We saw just two or three, maybe, probably in the first 15 years that we were here. But with milder winters that we're having, this past winter was a bit severe, but most of the winters generally are much milder now than they used to be. And raccoons are not hibernators. They just sort of hole up in a hollow tree or some kind of cranny they can find somewhere and sleep a lot in the winter and conserve energy. So the Adirondack winters, I think, have largely kept raccoons out from the colder parts of these mountains, but it's not keeping them out anymore, it doesn't seem like. So we're seeing raccoons frequently now at our place, and I see the tracks every time I take a walk.
You know, you bring up a point in the book about how at one point they were even popular pets, which is obviously not a good idea, but Calvin Coolidge had one in the White House, which is really interesting. When I was a kid, we had a pet raccoon, which, you know, and the only thing I can say about that is that it was pre-rabies. You know, we didn't have the rabies epidemic that we have, and it was fascinating because they're very endearing creatures.
Yeah, skunks were popular pets at one time. I know our local public library, one time I was browsing the nature section in the library, and I found a book, I think it was published in the 1950s, just a little tiny book, and it explained how you can go out and find a skunk den and basically steal one of the little skunk kits from the mother and bring it home and perform surgery on the kitchen table with some kitchen implements to remove the scent glands. It's hard to imagine doing that. And then make a pet of a skunk. So they were popular pets at one time.
I know that this is a popular thing. I know I have a friend who goes up to the Adirondacks and hikes looking for snakes. What is it about the snake population that is interesting to so many people within when they visit the park?
Yeah, it's funny that you raise the issue of snakes, because when I interact with people up here, I take a lot of people for walks and hikes and things, and they can see my love of the Adirondacks. But I have to confess, if I think the Adirondack Mountains have one shortcoming, is we could use more snakes. So I'm a snake lover. I love snakes. I lived in the South for a few years. I love snakes of all kinds, and we don't have a big diversity of snakes in the Adirondacks, and we don't have really large numbers of them. The only snake commonly that we see in our part of the Adirondacks is the garter snake. It's non-venomous, which makes most people happy. But we do have rattlesnakes in a few places along Lake George and Lake Champlain, and there are rat snakes down near Lake George, and some other very small snakes. There's some little slender things like ringneck snakes and red-bellied snakes, which are lovely little creatures, utterly harmless, couldn't bite you if they tried, and they're only about the size of a pencil.
One of the things that the Adirondacks is also known for are bugs and flies and how annoying that they can be, mosquitoes and so forth. Give us a sense of the things that can get you.
Well, we do have no shortage of those. So that's sometimes, you know, we grumble. We get so used to it being quiet up here, and tourist season comes, and suddenly it takes twice as long to drive anywhere. So Adirondackers who want to grumble about the tourists a little bit tend to remind themselves that they should be happy that we have amazing numbers of mosquitoes here, black flies, commonly May and June into early July, and no-see-ems, little tiny biting flies, deer flies. So fortunately, generally speaking, our insects are not carrying diseases, but they certainly can make life miserable at times.
When you take the walks that you mentioned, and I'm curious because you talked about a chapter early on in our conversation about where, you know, it's just sort of where you didn't know where else to put it. But when you want to show somebody something really interesting and fascinating and very unique to the Adirondacks, what do you show them?
Well, I never know what I'm going to show them, actually, Joe, because that's the way it is with nature, is you go out and you never know what will turn up. So rarely, I've never been able to show anybody a bear or a moose on a walk. We certainly, we can go to some areas where there are interesting birds and often find those. One of my great loves are amphibians, and I particularly love salamanders. So I often can take people to spots and where we can look under logs and things in the woods and have a very good chance of finding some interesting salamanders. But there are days when, you know, we don't see that much in the way of animal life. So that's where it pays to be a generalist, because there's always interesting things to look at and talk about. So just the trees themselves, you know, they're not hard to find and they're so interesting. And the forests, the Adirondacks certainly are among the most beautiful forests in the world. So it's a pleasure to share them with people.
Edward Kanz is an author, naturalist, guide, and photographer from the Adirondack Mountains and a columnist for Adirondack Explorer. His new book is The Nature of the Place on the Flora and Fauna of the Adirondacks. He will be speaking on April 30th at 6 p.m. at historic Saranac Lake, and it is a fantastic book and so much information. Edward, I thank you very much for being with us, and what a delight to have you on the program.
Hi, thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Nature of the Place on the Flora and Fauna of the Adirondacks. It is published by North Country Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.